this aspect of being limitless has always been a core driver for me. And when we have competitive companies, we have economic democracy. Everything comes down to the habits that you're making.
The term dynamo gets thrown around about startup CEOs quite a bit, but it only takes about 3 minutes sitting down with Nelly Wartoft to realize that she, even among an incredible set of peers, really is the real deal. Nelly Wartoft is the dynamic and exceptional CEO and founder of TigerHall. TigerHall is a change activation platform that supports organizational transformations through bite-sized content, real-time feedback, and analytics that currently works with some of the leading companies across the globe. Nelly's story is a testament to the power of perseverance, discipline, and a constant willingness to embrace change. In our conversation, we're going to dive into how her experience as a national skeet shooting champion shaped her entrepreneurial approach. The mission behind TigerHall and its focus on effective communication during organizational change. Her unique insights into industry trends, including consolidation and mega acquisitions and their impact on economic growth. And some practical strategies for habit stacking, productivity, and personal growth so that you too can unlock your next level of performance. Nelly's perspective on leadership, innovation, and building a culture of empowerment will leave you inspired. Let's jump into the conversation. I'm curious if there was a defining moment or early influence from your childhood that really influenced your approach to entrepreneurship or leadership in general.
So I've always been very interested in entrepreneurship. I'm someone that values independence highly and being able to push myself as far as I can go. And I usually call it being limitless. This aspect of being limitless has always been a core driver for me. So even when I was in my corporate career, which I did have for a part of my career as well, working in a large global corporation, what pushed me again to start my own business was like, I wanted to be limitless. I didn't want to have anyone telling me what I can do and what I can't do. So I think that is something that I've had from a very early age. My mom usually says, like, in my first couple of days, I was like, I can do this myself type of thing in life. I'm just looking around the room in a way that I can manage this. So that's always been a core driver for me. Very early, I started working when I was 12. I wanted to get myself out there, start learning and like start pushing myself into that world and not being in a like protected bubble, if you will. Yeah. And those early working experiences, both as an assistant to stroke patients, I was working at McDonald's, I was selling suits, I did a lot of things before I turned 18. Those experiences shaped a lot of who I am today as well and influenced definitely my entrepreneurship journey and leadership and just taught me how much I love doing so many of those things that I learned in those early years.
While you were doing all of that stuff, you were also kind of really excelling in this field that requires incredible focus and discipline. What are the things about really reaching that level of mastery in skeet shooting feel similar to reaching the level of excellence, quite frankly, that you've reached in the world of entrepreneurship? And what things feel different? Do you feel like you had to unlearn certain lessons or did everything feel pretty transferable?
That's a really well-phrased question. There are a lot of similarities, actually. I think the biggest similarity, I think, prevents a lot of people from reaching excellence. And I don't think that I've reached excellence in any way. But if I compare the small piece of success I've had in entrepreneurship and being a national champion in a sport, you need to do really, really boring things over and over and over and over and over again. And I think that is something that people don't realize about success because they have this picture of success as being something like you're always stimulated and it's challenging and you're having fun and it's like all these things happening, right? And people think that that is what success looks like. But actually, at least in my experience, success looks like doing the boring, tedious over and over and over again. So when I was a national champion in skeet shooting, I did 5,000 bullets a week. And that's not fun. It's not fun to shoot 5,000 bullets a week. And everything comes down to your clothing at that point. It comes down to like the fabric of your vests that you have when you stand up and how like a small little movement changes like 0.2 millimeters in where that bullet is going to hit. It's extremely tedious, detail-oriented, repetitive, super, super repetitive. Yeah. And when I think of entrepreneurship, right, if I look at the past 6 years of running Tiger Hall, it's a lot of the things I'm doing are very repetitive. I pitch Tiger Hall 10,000 times a day. I talk about the platform. I interview people. I do the same sales pitch over and over again. I do the same hiring pitch over and over again. And it's always about reaching out to people and connecting with people. And like, it's very much that is similar. So when people think that, oh, you've run this company for 6 years, they might think that, or like it's so many different things all the time and a lot of creativity and stimulation. Yeah. Actually, a lot of the time is just doing the boring things really, really well and doing them over and over and over again without losing stamina. So those 5,000 bullets, like equal that to 5,000 outreach to sell to a new customer, like finding your first customers, right? Or finding a bunch of capital funding, like whatever it is. I've done way more than 5,000 of those first ones, right? So that, I think, is the biggest similarity between them.
Where do you think that discipline to kind of stick with the boring stuff came from? Is that something you think was kind of an innate orientation that you had? Or is that something that you think was learned?
I think it's a bit of both. I've always been very, very disciplined and very like, high level of self-discipline, high level of like organization, high level of grit and resilience. And just like, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. But I also think it's learned because you see success from it. Like I saw when I moved from doing 2,000 bullets a week to 3,000 bullets a week, I saw the difference. Did I want 1,000 more bullets? No, I didn't want to do that. Like, that's not how I want to spend my time. But this concept of delayed gratification, I think is... yeah, part innate, but also to a large part learned. And I think actually parents have a big responsibility in teaching their children the concept of delayed gratification.
Yeah.
But that's also self-reinforced when you see it happening. So when I saw this, like, okay, I've put in so much work and all this discipline, and then I'm the number one in the entire country. That makes up for it. And even now, like say 95% of my time is repetitive, like less stimulating tasks. Like, that is worth it to get that like 5% high. That is like an absolute insane feeling, right?
Yeah.
So I think you also self-learn over time, but you need to start putting yourself in it to begin with to actually get those gratifying moments back. And then you learn and then you keep going with it because you know that those last 5 or 1% is going to be so worth the first 90, 95% of your time that you put in.
What was the initial inspiration behind Tiger Hall? What was the gap you saw in your market? And who do you think of as your ideal customer profile?
Yeah, so I thought of Tiger Hall when I was in corporate. And it was very much inspired by how we engage and consume content, communications, information outside of work compared to what it was like to come into the office on a Monday morning. So you would come from a weekend full of Instagram, Spotify, TikTok, Amazon. Everything is one click away. It's easy. It's engaging. Like, it doesn't require much effort in that sense. And then you come into the office on a Monday morning and you're like, where was that SharePoint site again? Like, where do I need to go to find that PowerPoint deck? And then I have 300 internal emails that are not targeted to me. It's not relevant to me and my role. So the entire concept of engagement and personalization and using data, like, I didn't see that being used in communications, capability building, knowledge sharing in the workplace the way it was used outside of the workplace. So that was the initial spark. And the problems that this created, right, is that employees are just so overwhelmed with everything being thrown at them in like 17 different destinations, and it's an email here, there's a town hall there, there's a SharePoint site you have to look at here. And it's hard for them to consume and understand this information in a way that makes sense for them, because it's just this one size fits none kind of approach. And this is especially hard in change and transformation. So when we started out, we were focused on more generally, like, how do we engage people in their development, in communications, and like making them connected to the company and making them connected to their like leadership and things like that. But then we realized the biggest pain point is actually, if you're driving a big change and transformation initiative, it's so, so critical to have people understand what it is you're doing, having them being on board, having them being supportive of the change, because 70 to 80% of change transformation still fails because of the people aspect. So people create these great plans and strategies. They spend millions of dollars on consulting firms. Then they have this beautiful PowerPoint deck. And then the PowerPoint deck hits the people and they're like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not on board with this. And that's when things start to go sideways. So that's the problem that we solve for, is how do you engage people in change and driving change and transformation at scale in a large enterprise? And that includes communication, which is so, so critical, because communication is a huge issue in almost every company, and getting the right information to the right person at the right time in a way that they want to be communicated to. So change communications is a big piece. And then you have the underlying mindset changes, the capability building, the knowledge that is happening to enable that entire transformation that we also solve for. So our ICP are chief transformation officers, head of transformation office, head of change management in large enterprises. So leaders who are driving big change initiatives for a large employee population, those are the ones that we work with today.
When you think about some of the biggest challenges you had to overcome to get from kind of this idea to what Tiger Hall is today, what are some of the stories that come to mind and how did you overcome them?
I think some of the challenges is always keeping up with the market, right? Like you have, the market is moving so quickly and adjusting and addressing like those shifting market needs. It's an interesting challenge. It's an intellectually stimulating challenge. So that's what I really enjoy about it. We started in Singapore, headquartered in Singapore, started in Asia, then quite quickly got traction with large American multinationals. And I had no plans on expanding to the US. But then these big American companies using it in Asia and then going, hang on, can we use this in the US too? And starting to use it in the US, like, oh, like maybe we should go to the US market. So 2 years ago, we launched here, and now it's over 80% of our revenue is from the US. So staying tuned to like what resonates with whom, and the same with the personas. We just spoke about the ICP. Initially, we were focused on selling into HR usually, and people are like more on the people side of things. And then we noticed that the people who actually feel this pain the most and who care the most about this problem is actually change and transformation leaders, because those are the ones that witness their projects and their initiatives being delayed and being like failing and not going the way they wanted to. So that's another like pivot, if you will, that we made is also the persona that we sell to. Of course, technology comes all the time. I mean, Gen AI is something everyone is talking about. So even communications, a big part of the product is content and content delivery. So we've incorporated a lot of Gen AI in terms of how you create content, how you disseminate it, how you put it together quickly, summarize it, and so on. So that's something that I had planned for 2 years ago, right? Before ChatGPT and so on came out. So you can never kind of have a 10-year plan or even a 5-year plan, right? You'd always have to have principles that you believe in that makes you stay true to your mission and vision, but you have to be open to changing. And so it's kind of this concept of like strong beliefs loosely held, saying it, because where we started, which was very much Asia and people focused and communications and these pieces, now is totally US market change and transformation. So those are big changes, right? Those have been fascinating to go through.
What feels like it's top of mind for some of the leading firms in the country? And what do you think are some of the implications for where we're going to go in 2025 and beyond?
That's a good question. Yeah, we do work with a lot of Fortune 500s, Fortune 1000 type of size companies. So it is the large, well-known brands and what they're driving and changing. Like the obvious one is obviously AI and the operational efficiencies that that drives, right? And I think that, I mean, from what I'm seeing in the conversations I'm having, it's very much focused on like amplifying humans and like making them better. It's not so much about replacing humans as I think employees think it is, at least at this stage. Like you might want to get there at some point in the future. But like last week, for example, we saw Jamie Dimon, right, go out and say that employees should work 3.5 days a week and it should be like AI enabled and this and that. Now, of course, if it gets to that point and he just ends up laying off 40% of the workforce, that remains to be seen, right? Yeah. But at least the conversations I'm having and what I'm seeing is more of that. How can we augment human productivity and how can we make people faster and better, and especially like the cost efficiencies around that. So I think the whole AI one is an obvious one. Some of the less obvious one that I hear a lot of talk about is, I mean, you always have the reorgs and the restructurings, and it's kind of a pendulum that swings between local empowerment and centralized, like COEs, and having everything in the center. Right now, where that pendulum is moving is very much towards central power, compared to like a few years ago, where I saw more like local focus. So a lot of things now are like building COEs, centralizing power to headquarters, and being a bit more controlled in that way. So that's one that I see. And then the third thing I would say is it's a lot of mega acquisitions happening right now. If you look at the rate of industry consolidation right now in the US and how many mega acquisitions and companies are merging, take a guess, how many companies do you think will exist in the US in 2070 if the rate of industry consolidation continues as it does now? What do you think in 2070?
I'm scared to embarrass myself with the like right answer there. 50,000?
That's a good guess, but it's far from the truth. It's one. The answer is one. There'll be one company in the US in 2070 if we continue to just consolidate. And you see this across energy, you see it in consumer goods, you see it in financial services. It's so many large companies that come together and merge and acquire. So that's another big trend, is all of these mega acquisitions. And if you look at deal volume, it's actually gone down in the past 2 years. The deal value is up like 40, 50% across most industries. Some industries even up like 200%. So that's fewer acquisitions, but larger acquisitions. So that's also why I think change and transformation is so, so incredibly important, because it allows companies to stay competitive. And when we have competitive companies, we have economic democracy, we have a free market, we have all the benefits that come with that. And if you have one company that runs the world, then that's not great for anyone. And economic growth and equality, all of those areas will suffer. So mega acquisitions is a tough one, because it is... larger companies are becoming less and less competitive, which means other larger companies, then that, of course, leads to a lot of change and transformation happening as well. So I would say that's probably the third thing I'm seeing a lot of activity around.
I'm curious, when you think about your own journey the last 6 years, what feels as true today as it did in the beginning about who you are and how you lead, and what feels markedly different?
So some of the things that I'm still doing is I'm a very empowering leader and trusting leader. I tend to have the philosophy that I hire great people and I allow them to get great work done. I put a lot of trust in my people. Do some people take advantage of that trust and have they historically? Yes, there have been a few bad eggs, but I just always trust people, and they know that once I hire them, they have 100% of my trust that I'm going to do whatever it takes to make them successful. So that hasn't changed, and that's still how I operate today. I think what has changed, what I'm still trying to be better at, is I'm a productivity addict. So I have like a very strong addiction to always doing something and being like productive. And sometimes that can get in the way of certain functions in the business. So for example, like I'm very passionate about sales and I love sales. And sometimes that can mean I'm a little bit too involved or like too hands-on with sales. And I know that as we grow and scale, that's something I need to continue working on. Like, how do I satisfy my addiction or solve for my addiction? how do I get sober from this productivity addiction, and doing that in a way that I can still use it as my superpower, but that it doesn't interfere with the team? So that's a shift that I'm actively trying to make, is how do I become a better leader in working like through them and with them and lifting them up and so on, and not letting my productivity addiction get in the way where I would get in just like, oh, like I'm just gonna do it over the weekend, right? And then I write it's all done. Like, it's better experience for them and for the business long term to work with it together. So I think that's one that I've tried to shift, and I'm still working on shifting.
When you identify kind of an area for growth for yourself as a leader that you want to go after, what tools do you find most helpful in making that adjustment?
So I do coaching. So I have a coach. I actually have two coaches. I have one that is more like personal, like me, myself, like my mindset. Yeah. And then I have a business coach. So I meet with both of them. It's like once a quarter. So it's not a very frequent engagement, but I still have them to open up my mind to things that I probably haven't thought of myself. Mm-hmm. And then I read a lot. I'm a very big reader. So that's something I spend a lot of time on. And then when I've decided that this is something that I want to do and want to improve in, I do habit stacking a lot. So I work it and I have this app on my phone. So again, like gaming my own productivity addiction.
Yeah.
I have this habit stack where I can then fill in my streaks and everything that I'm doing. So I usually break it down. So I take like, this is the goal. This is what I want to change. Then I break it down into smaller pieces, have those like sometimes milestones, sometimes smaller things that I want to achieve, and then break that down to what does that look like on a daily or weekly basis. Because for humans, it's good to have, of course, we have annual goals and quarterly goals and all of that is there. But I think it's so critical for most people to break it down to the changes you're making on a day to day, because that's how you achieve anything. Everything comes down to the habits that you're making daily or weekly. So the more you can break your change down and the more you can make it like not eat the elephant, right? But eat it in many small pieces. Yeah. And then always tying that back. I have my annual intentions and then I have my quarterly intentions. But then from there, I break it down to monthly and weekly plans. And then every Sunday night, this is my favorite thing. Every Sunday night, I spend 1 or 2 hours on thinking through the week, planning out every single part of my calendar. So my calendar is exactly what I'm going to do every, it's usually like half an hour blocks. This half an hour, I do this, this half an hour, I do that. And then I basically don't look at my to-do list throughout the week. I just look at my calendar. And do whatever is on the calendar with no negotiation. If it says I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So I'm working on breaking it down and actually spending the time there, because I think a lot of people might not spend the time in planning and they have this big goal, but then they struggle. What should I do today to reach that goal? So I think whatever change it is, incorporating it in small micro doses throughout and then habit stack. So having something that you don't have to think about, like basically you want to be able to turn off your brain in some ways and just like pilot, like working out the same time every week and things like that. Humans thrive on routine. So those are some of the things that I find at least works for me.
How have you thought about community for yourself, both from a professional and a personal perspective? And has that changed over time?
Yeah, community is incredibly important. Glad you bring it up, because I think many people get lonelier and lonelier and then they might not reflect on how that affects their mood, for example. For me, I'm a super extrovert. I'm 97 on the extrovert scale. I get all my energy from talking to people and meeting new people. So I've been very intentional about how I get that source of energy. Because for me, if I don't meet anyone on the weekend, if I just have a quiet weekend at home, I'm so tired on Monday. I really have no energy. Whereas if I've had, it's like been brunches and lunches and going out and with people and go surfing with friends, like I have so much energy on Monday. So I've been very conscious about how do I feed that energy. Back to my like habit stacking and breaking it down weekly, I actually have a KPI of meeting people, new people in person 3 times a week. I've started using an app that I really like called Time Left, shameless plug. Time Left is great. You meet 5 new strangers every Wednesday night and they hook you up randomly with random people for dinner. That's been really great for me because it's otherwise I work usually from like 7 a.m. to midnight and 5 days a week straight. Like this Wednesday night, just get out for 2 to 3 hours. So I use that. I'm also part of YPO, which is like young CEOs type of community. So YPO has been great. And then through the VCs that are backing Tiger Hall as well, like with Peak 15, for example, former Sequoia Capital, they have the Surge community and we have WhatsApp groups and meeting in person. So I think the founder community is actually very strong. And I have a number of those founder groups through different avenues. So that's been a very strong professional community. And then like joining clubs like in the Venice Surfing Association as a surf club, for example. So just trying to be part of groups. But I think it requires intention. And that's why I think apps like A Time Left, there's also 222. I think they're successful because the loneliness epidemic is real, right? Whether you're a CEO or not, like, people are very lonely nowadays. And especially after the pandemic, it's easy to just fall into the trap of sitting at home and not really pushing yourself to go out there and meet new people. So I think that's why those apps have been popular, because it pushes you to do that. It's like every Wednesday night you meet new people and just like makes that into habit again. So again, coming back to habit stacking, intention is very key in building community.
So much goodness there, but I want to shift gears a little bit as we kind of come to the close and go back to the core of what you guys are doing at Tiger Hall with change management. After watching so many of these organizations run these massive global change efforts, what are some of the stuff that people keep getting wrong that you wish that they did not?
Quite a few things. if I focus on the top ones that I think are the easier to address than some of the deeper responses. Yeah. For example, like many times you might have like the wrong CEO, for example. It's hard sometimes to do something about that. Like you've got this ability about, like it's okay. But I think some of the easier things to do is changing how you communicate from this very formal, scripted, stiff, kind of controlled way of communication, which is very common in especially more traditional organizations, getting from that to a more transparent, raw, real, authentic way of communicating. So think of the way that people communicate on like a TikTok, right? Like it's camera, it's very raw and real. And that's why TikTok surged over Instagram, because Instagram is still pretty curated and filtered and TikTok isn't. That actually works for communication as well. We see by far the most success when companies just have their leaders like pick up their phone and go like talk to the camera and record quickly and post it out. Like just being raw, real, being human. Like people crave humanity and they want human leaders. So the more human you can be in your communications and the less of this like suit and tie, green screen, super produced, 12 PR people in the room, like that doesn't really fly anymore. And I think that's a relatively easy one to do. And the second I would say is personalization of the communication, of the messaging. I actually say that you can get to 40% of personalization just by using like static basic data, like where do people live, like what's their geography, what's their language, seniority, tenure with a company, just using some of these basic information. Like you can have many other data sources that brings you to the 100% and like all on personalization, but you can get quite far with just those initial ones. And I still see so many organizations sending out the same message to everyone, regardless of if they are a CFO in Japan or an SDR in Brazil. That basic personalization, I think, is also a relatively easy one that makes it a lot better. Yeah. And that part that I think many organizations are still missing is two-way feedback loops. They send everything out, and there is no way for employees to share their input, ask any follow-up questions, get help. Like, and then people just abandon it, right? Because it's top-down, it's spoken at them. They have no idea how this relates to them, and they can't raise their hand and say, hey, like, I don't understand this, or what does this mean? So when you don't have those two-way feedback loops, it makes it much harder both for the employees because they don't understand what's going on, but also for the change leader because they don't have the data on what are people thinking, saying, feeling, how are they receiving this change? They have no idea. So it just becomes this big black hole. So those two-way feedback loops are very critical as well.
Has Tiger Hall gone after that question of two-way feedback loops very specifically? And what's the Tiger Hall solve for that element of the challenge?
So we have a lot of two-way feedback loops in the platform. So when people receive the communication, which is integrated in their workflows, they might receive it through Microsoft Teams, for example, if that's the platform they're using. It's a quick video. And then literally next to the video, you have thumbs up, you have thumbs down, you have emoji reactions, you have comments, you can share, like you can tag people, you can ask questions. Like all of that interaction is right where you consume the information, which is also critical. So it can't be like, oh, like send an email to this email address and we'll respond to you in 30 days. Like that's not So having that directness and being exactly where people consume it is very critical. So that's something that we have built in. And then that generates social sentiment analysis. So while you don't have to, if you have 50,000 employees, you can't go in and reply everyone, right? Yeah. But it gives you a sentiment analysis so that you can address the audiences at large. So you might see that, oh, my sales team in Canada are very skeptical about this part of the change. Let me go with this message from the head of sales in Canada, so a person they trust, and deliver this message that addresses this concern to them. So it's not about a one-to-one reply, but it's ensuring that you understand what people's concerns and questions and hesitations are so that you can address them further in your targeting, in your messaging, and so on. So that's the two-way feedback loop. It's more of two-way feedback loops en masse than that like one-to-one. And you can, of course, go in and reply one-to-one if you'd like to, but usually if you have 50,000 people, that's doable. But people are very happy if they've put something in and then they actually receive something back because they're like, hey, we heard you and this is what we're doing. Wanted to address this and Kevin here is going to talk to you about it or whatever. So that's how it works in Tiger Hall, which is very effective because it helps change and transformation leaders understand problems before they become big uncontrollable problems that they no longer have any chance of addressing. So it makes them catch the problems early.
If you kind of take a look back to Nelly before Tiger Hall, what advice would you give her?
I would maybe tell her to do a little bit more research before making decisions. I think sometimes I've been making decisions based on, it's always hard to make decisions when you have limited information, but many times I think I could have had more information than I did at the time of decisions. I prioritized speed sometimes. Some decisions, and I'm like, it's more important that we get this done fast and that we move quickly than that I'm making the right decision. Many of those decisions I made have ended up being good decisions, but also many of them have not ended up being good decisions and wasted time. And like, for example, we've launched certain markets that were not great markets at all for Tiger Hall. Those markets I could have avoided launching if I would have spent a little bit more time speaking with people in that market, even doing just like primary research. So, but where it was like certain signals, like, okay, let's go into this market and launch. So that's where I could have saved time. Because I do have an approach of talking to a lot of people, and that's usually how I learn, is I reach out to a bunch of people, like, hey, how did you solve for this? How did you do it? And learning. But I think there's still areas where I could have done that more in hindsight than I did.
If Nelly then could see you today, what do you think she would tell you?
She would be very impressed. And like, I'm not impressed with myself now, but if she knew that this would even exist in 6 years,
she
would be surprised. I thought, as most startup founders do, like, you know, it's going to die within 1 or 2 years, right? Like, that's the thing. And I still feel like every year I'm like, we're going to die this year. We're going to die this year. We're going to die this year. So that's the existential crisis that you always have as a startup founder. I would not have believed that I would sit in the US on the other side of the world 6 years later with a business that has over 80% of revenue from the American market and working with the customers that we work with, the size and the scale and the logos. If she would have seen this now, she would probably be pretty impressed, which is a nice question. It's a good reminder because I never think about that. But I would have been impressed.
And that brings us to the end of today's conversation with Nelly Wartoft. From her entrepreneurial roots to her vision for transforming corporate communication with Tiger Hall, Nelly's journey showcases the resilience, discipline, and innovation required to drive meaningful change. Thank you, Nelly, for sharing your insights and experiences with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the podcast for more visionary conversations. And make sure you share your favorite takeaway in the comments or on social media using our hashtag #VentureVisionaries. And remember, meaningful growth happens when we're curious, intentional, and unafraid to embrace change. Until next time, this is Thomas Igeme, signing off from Venture Visionaries. Keep dreaming big and leading boldly. I'll see you next time.